Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. Today we have a case of the walking wounded. So we're both sitting down. Today we've succeeded in snaring another distinguished foreigner, as we had last time. Dr. Patricia Sykes is with us on a Fulbright scheme for a time at the Australian National University. She's a very distinguished professor of political science from the United States, and we have captured her on this International Women's Day to speak on a relevant topic. Please welcome her.
Thank you. I'd like to start by thanking a couple of people, actually. The staff who work for the Senate Lecture Series, who did so much to plan and prepare this event, and also people from the Fulbright Commission and Australian National University. I can see two people in the audience in particular, the Executive Director of the Australian-American Fulbright Commission, Mark Darby, and the liaison between Fulbright and ANU, Professor John Hart. So I would like to thank them and, in fact, everybody, as I said, who brought me here for this special opportunity as a Fulbright scholar. I'm very happy to be here to have an opportunity to talk to you about my research, and I look forward to your comments and questions at the conclusion. For several years, pundits have been speculating about Senator Hillary Clinton's prospects of becoming the first president, woman president of the United States. Preoccupied with the question, can she win, very few commentators have stopped to consider whether a woman president would make a difference. Senator Clinton herself recently declared that her presidency would signal a sea change in public policy and send a stirring message to millions that any girl in America can grow up to become president. And I think if she actually wins the nomination and the election, she will very quickly discover that many aspects of our institutions, our ideology, and even our evolution make it very difficult for women executives to engender change, to promote policies that advance the interests or enhance the status of women. In this respect, the United States is not entirely alone or exceptional. Only two Anglo systems have elected women chief executives, the United Kingdom and New Zealand. And New Zealand, as you know, has recently reformed its system. So Helen Clark has succeeded in a system that's quite different from all the other Anglo systems. Canada allowed its first and only woman prime minister to lead for a few months before she faced and failed to win a general election. And, of course, the Republic of Ireland has elected two women presidents, but the Irish presidency remains a largely ceremonial post, despite the best efforts of Mary Robinson to expand the scope of its influence. So while the United States and Australia remain the only two Anglo countries that have never had a woman executive, the other nations have very little to boast about. Now, ironically, Anglo-American systems often serve as models of democracy for the rest of the world. But the experience of women leaders calls into question, I think, the democratic character of our regimes. With the exception of New Zealand, Anglo-American systems rank low on the list of modern liberal democracies in terms of the representation and leadership of women. Once women do make it to the top, very few of them manage to achieve their central policy goals. Anglo-American institutions, ideology, and political development are highly masculinist, which is to say they privilege traditional masculine attributes or traits in leaders. And masculinism presents significant challenges for women executives, especially those who attempt to engender change. Now, today I'm going to say a little bit more about why and how that's the case and offer you some illustrations. To facilitate programmatic change, adversarial systems concentrate power in the executive. And to ensure accountability, they rely on combat between the two major political parties. In general, the more adversarial the system is, the more masculinist its norms and expectations of executive leadership tend to be. Of course, the role of commander-in-chief and superpower status magnify masculinism in the U.S. presidency. But a measure of masculinism characterizes most aspects of executive leadership in all Anglo-adversarial systems. Women leaders in such systems usually need to develop styles and strategies that show that they are capable of being strong, tough, determined, and decisive. Margaret Thatcher, the best known and perhaps the most successful woman leader in the Anglo world, adopted exactly that approach. Thatcher insisted that she alone had the remedy for the problems that plagued Britain, and she described her public philosophy in highly masculinist terms, by extolling the virtues of rugged individualism and fierce anti-communism. Moreover, she developed a distinctly masculinist style, which she described in her first general election campaign when she declared, "I am a conviction politician." She said, in the Old Testament, the Old Testament prophets did not say, "Brothers, let's build a consensus." They said, "This is my faith and my vision. This is what I passionately believe. If you believe it too, then follow me." It was that style, as much as the substance of her leadership, that conjured up the image of Boadicea, the ancient warrior queen, and earned her the appellation Iron Lady. In the combative environment of the British adversarial system, the practice of conviction politics enables women to come closer to meeting the gender-specific requirements and expectations of executive leadership. Compared with politicians who equivocate and backpedal, conviction politicians promise to provide strong, decisive leadership. Thatcher shows how women who practice conviction-style leadership can manage to convey the requisite masculine attributes by appearing tough, firm, and determined. For most of her premiership, an overwhelming majority of the public admired Thatcher for precisely these leadership qualities, even when they opposed her specific policies. Throughout the Anglo-American world, by the early 1990s, Thatcher and her counterparts overseas had become personally unpopular, although a new consensus had emerged based on the neoliberal changes they enacted in the 1980s. Their immediate successors faced a substantial challenge. They needed to distance themselves from their radical predecessors without denouncing their parties and by maintaining the new neoliberal consensus. In Canada, when Kim Campbell replaced Brian Mulroney as Prime Minister, she inherited an environment similar to the situation faced by Thatcher's successor, John Major, and Reagan's successor, George Herbert Walker Bush. These kinder, gentler times, to borrow a phrase from Bush, might be considered more feminist, which is to say they favor traditional feminine attributes or virtues, and thereby enhance prospects for a woman leader. Yet even in an environment that calls for conciliation, moderation, and maintaining consensus, essentially a softer style of leadership, Anglo-adversarial arrangements generate highly masculinist expectations of the executive. To a great extent, Campbell confronted the dilemma by pursuing the same strategy Major and Bush adopted. All of them avoided taking precise policy positions and issued mainly ambiguous, equivocal statements. Admittedly, their critics allege that both Bush and Major lacked vision. But this is what Bush in his presidency called the vision thing that haunted him for so many years. And Campbell might well have created the same impression during her 1993 campaign. Instead, as a woman, Campbell's evasions conveyed incompetence and ignorance. No one ever questioned the intelligence of Major or Bush, and Bush won. But Campbell's vague statements raised doubts about her abilities. Never mind that she had been a university lecturer in political science, whom critics had once condemned for her intellectual elitism. When Campbell adopted the strategy of her male counterparts, her image went from egghead to airhead, and of course the media magnified the metamorphosis. Campbell also attracted criticism when she chose to articulate specific positions. She continued to advocate many neoliberal policies, but she was a feminist who believed the state should play a positive role in setting social policy. In fact, it was the substance and style of her feminism that frequently foiled her efforts. The government rejected her proposals to reform the judicial system, for example, because they would constitute special treatment for women. When she practiced what she called the politics of inclusion by holding more cabinet meetings and consulting provincial premiers, she appeared weak and unable to make a decision on her own. Even her refusal to be stage managed during the campaign made her seem naive. As a feminist, Campbell wanted to defy stereotypes, not reinforce them, but she repeatedly ran up against the highly masculinist norms embedded in the position of the Canadian Prime Minister and in the prevailing ideology. In the 1993 election, Campbell's Progressive Conservative Party retained only 2 seats with 17% of the vote, and Campbell failed to carry her own riding in Vancouver. Several factors account for their loss, and the party won roughly the same percentage of the vote that it had secured in the public opinion polls when Mulroney resigned and Campbell became leader. Nevertheless, after handing her the poison chalice, the Conservatives blamed her for their devastating loss and then forced her to resign shortly after the election. Among Anglo-American women leaders, the only one who has managed to succeed by following a conciliatory, consensus-building approach is New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark. Like other Anglo nations, New Zealand experienced the neoliberal revolution of the 1980s, but by the 1990s, the public desired maintenance, not change, cooperation, and conciliation, not combat. The 1999 general election that put Clark in the premiership indicates how a less masculinist, more feminist environment made a difference. With two women leading the two major political parties, an editorial writer for the New Zealand Herald observed, "Women will not be alone in looking forward to a more feminine style of debate." The media found few differences between Clark and her major opponent, Jenny Shipley, but neither candidate suffered as a result. As one journalist put it, "This election is about caring, not daring. It will not be a case of who dares wins, because none of the parties likely to win seats has any daring policies at all they've announced to date." Throughout the campaign, both Shipley and Clark delivered vague, equivocal statements about their party's policies, and yet they escaped the harsh treatment Campbell received in Canada. As Australians know, New Zealand's neoliberal revolution had been much more radical than in other Anglo countries. The nation went from having one of the most controlled economies to adopting an open, unregulated market. In contrast to other countries, in New Zealand, the Labour Party initiated the neoliberal policies, and Labour Prime Minister Clark only wanted to halt the change, not reverse it. Strategically situating her party in the middle of the ideological spectrum, she quickly endorsed the centrist approach of President Bill Clinton and Prime Minister Tony Blair, known as the Third Way. Yet Clark differs from these men in the value she places on social and economic policies that affect women. She is a self-described feminist who first became involved in the women's movement as a student activist. In my interview with her, she reflected on her government's major policies concerning health, education, and welfare by highlighting their positive impact on women. And Clark has engendered some change, incrementally and while exercising fiscal restraint. Several factors explain Clark's success. She has had an advantage as the second woman prime minister, though the first elected, in a country with the highest representation of women in the Anglo-American world, and the only country to make the top 10 worldwide. The incremental changes that Clark is able to achieve suit her strategic environment in terms of public opinion, but that was also true of Kim Campbell in Canada. When the electorate is concentrated in the center with a high degree of consensus, the institutions must generate norms and expectations that women can more easily meet. Perhaps Clark's greatest advantage was the introduction of mixed member proportional representation, or MMP. She has been prime minister in a recently reformed system that greatly reduces the masculinist norms and expectations of executive leadership that prevail in the other Anglo-American systems. When New Zealanders adopted MMP, they wanted a system more representative than first past the post. But even more important, they wanted to check against the excessive executive power that had produced these dramatic radical changes. In the post-MMP regime, New Zealanders expect their leaders to be conciliatory, willing to compromise, and able to maintain consensus, attributes traditionally nurtured in and exhibited by women. As a woman in this system, Clark could more easily satisfy the expectations of executive leadership than her counterparts in adversarial systems. Public opinion polls attest to Clark's success in satisfying post-MMP public expectations. For example, several polls indicate that she is greatly admired for her flexibility. In that case, a vice in an adversarial system, what Americans disparage as flip-flopping, is actually a virtue in a system with MMP. By contrast, in adversarial systems, the institutions continue to generate distinctly masculinist norms, even when the electorate demands a softer style of leadership in kinder, gentler, more feminist times. As a result, women leaders frequently get caught in a double bind. Consider the dilemma that Senator Hillary Clinton has encountered in the 2008 primaries. Clinton has generally followed Thatcher's example and presents herself as the strong, experienced candidate capable of tackling tough decisions whether they're on war or on matters of law and order. Her campaign commercials emphasize her can-do spirit and commanding capabilities. But initially, the public responded by perceiving her as cold and hard-hearted. Throughout the nominating process, polls have repeatedly shown the American public searching for a conciliator, not a combatant, in the Washington partisan battlefield. In the New Hampshire primary campaign, Clinton tried to soften her image by showing a bit of emotion when she expressed her concern for and her commitment to her country. The tracks of her tears, as Sky Television tagged the story, might have won the hearts of some voters, but it immediately sparked her opponents to question her qualifications for commander-in-chief. In this primary season, public expectations of leadership and the institutional norms of the presidency call for conflicting gender-specific qualities, and the only woman candidate in the contest is caught in the conflict. Anglo nations have produced one serious woman prospective president and a few prime ministers. But cabinet ministers provide more examples of women struggling to meet gender-specific norms of executive leadership in Anglo countries. Just as significant, their experience also illustrates how masculinism pervades recent ideological and institutional developments. In the case of Anglo countries, liberalism constitutes the dominant ideology, and it is a distinctly masculinist ideology in both its classical form and its neo-reincarnation. In classical theory, liberalism embraces the concept of a disembodied, genderless individual, making it difficult for women to redress or seek redress under the law for the concrete ways that their experiences differ from those of men. In Anglo nations, women leaders are likely to be liberal, or even neoliberal, feminists, if they are feminists at all. And so the liberal ideological framework limits the degree of change they seek, even in the best of times. Neoliberalism makes matters worse for women because its market-oriented ideology shifts public policy away from the goal of equality to equity, fairness, and impartiality, reinforcing the bias of classical liberal theory that fails to recognize differences between men and women. Just as important, in a neoliberal period of fiscal conservatism, budgetary constraints have made it difficult for women leaders to promote new social and economic programs or protect existing ones from cuts. As a result, neoliberal times impose new limits on the ambition and creativity of women as increasing numbers of them move into cabinet posts. Most of the women ministers in Anglo systems have occupied posts that deal with domestic policies and programs. Traditionally, women have dealt with the domestic in the home, so it is not surprising to find them in charge of similar duties in government. In fact, politicians, the press, and the public often consider subjects such as education, health, and welfare women's issues, and polling data consistently show that women do care about these issues more than men. In cabinet, many of these positions threaten to become regendered as the women's posts. As Mary Hanafin, the Minister for Education in Ireland, declared, "I can go to a European council now, and all the education ministers are women. It's kind of a branding, almost." In the case of women cabinet ministers in the last 25 years or so, they have also been the areas that have endured the most severe budget cuts or diminished rates of funding. As a consequence, the political costs of implementing the neoliberal agenda have outweighed many benefits women might have derived from fitting into feminist slots. In the UK, budget cuts in education started in the 1970s and continued until the 21st century. Ironically, Thatcher was the first woman education secretary, who was forced to endure the unpopularity of budget cuts. When the Conservative government decided that older elementary school children could no longer receive free milk, the popular press vilified Thatcher the milk snatcher and asked, how could a woman deprive children of milk? Several subsequent women ministers in charge of feminist domestic policies, such as education, health, and welfare, would suffer similar fates. Thatcherism lingered long after her premiership, and when Labour returned to government after 18 years in opposition, its women ministers continued to endure the political costs of budget cuts. Dubbed Blair's Babes by the Times of London, 101 women Labour MPs won seats in the 1997 election. The Labour Party had taken several affirmative steps to increase the representation of women, adopting women-only shortlists for parliamentary candidates, and reserving at least 3 spots in the shadow cabinet. The party required Prime Minister Blair to bring members of the shadow cabinet into government, and predictably he placed all but one of the women in domestic posts. The first time a British government included many women ministers, the Prime Minister put them in positions where they would encounter stringent fiscal constraints and substantial political controversy, as the case of the current Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, Harriet Harman, illustrates. As Secretary of State for Social Security, Harman was responsible for cutting benefits for lone parents, a policy New Labour called the New Deal for Lone Parents, essentially a neoliberal program that substituted workfare for welfare. Gender clearly colored much of the criticism directed at Harman. As she described the flack she got, she conveyed the tone of the attack. "You're forcing women, you're forcing mothers to work. You don't value motherhood." It was a woman, she explained, cutting women's benefits. "I mean, if I had been a gray anonymous man, then I could have got away with it. But I was incredibly high profile." Now, Blair might have thought that a woman could more easily institute these cuts and soften their impact, but instead the media magnified the maternal role and Harman's failure to fulfill it. Admittedly, as part of the New Labour movement, Harman had supported the party's commitment to maintain fiscal restraint. In its manifesto, Labour promised to adhere to the conservative spending limits, at least for its first 2 years in government. That electoral pledge helped to modernize party policy and proved successful at the polls. But it also placed the Minister for Social Security in a politically untenable position, conceivably the worst spot in the New Labour government. Harman continued to explain, "I inherited a budget that was going down. So I had to stand in the dispatch box, newly elected as the New Labour government, and say, 'Hello, we're Labour. We're here to cut all your benefits.' Well, you can imagine that was not very popular. It caused absolute turmoil and uproar," she said. Harman believes the policy ultimately proved successful when she had been sacked and the government started putting benefits up. But to achieve that success, she served as the sacrificial lamb on the altar of electoral expediency and in the name of economic efficiency. In Ireland during the period of economic reform, one woman minister, Gemma Hussey, successively occupied all 3 of the highly sensitive feminist posts: Minister of Education, Minister for Social Welfare, and Minister for Health. As Hussey described her experience, she recalled, "Because of the fiscal constraints, from day one I was thrown into the deep end. Any attempt to introduce any cutback was opposed bitterly in Parliament. You go into the Dáil every day and you're faced with the howling mobs, the teachers' unions, the parents' associations. I was the villain, the number one villain for most of the time." When Hussey needed to cut one of the teachers' training colleges, she recalled, "You'd think I had declared World War III. The reaction was so," she paused, "well, I was never off the front page, it seemed to me." Inevitably, and to her dismay, the mass media compared Hussey with her nemesis Thatcher. In Australia, one of the first woman cabinet ministers, Margaret Guilfoyle, served successively as Minister of Education, Minister of Social Security, and Minister of Finance in Liberal governments. And she expressed some of the same sentiments as Harman and Hussey. According to Guilfoyle, "At the Social Security Department, you'd wake up every morning thinking, who hates us today?" In her 2 feminist posts, Guilfoyle was subject to the same scrutiny and harsh criticism as her Anglo counterparts. In Anglo-American countries, only a few women have occupied the highly masculinist cabinet posts pertaining to finance, justice, and foreign affairs. Masculinist norms and expectations have always pervaded these positions, but neoliberalism seemed to intensify and exaggerate the need for masculine virtues of strength, toughness, and hard-heartedness. Finance ministers in the neoliberal era needed to make cold, calculating cuts, and they left no room for bleeding hearts, as Ruth Richardson put it. Justice ministers had to convey their ability to maintain law and order more than ever before. And even when a woman managed to meet masculinist standards, the media might well mock her for her masculinity. Americans will remember the depiction of Janet Reno on Saturday Night Live. I don't know if it was ever shown over here. In foreign affairs, the global status of the nation affects the degree of masculinity demanded of a minister. But neoliberalism in international politics has generally required a leader willing to fight fearlessly for freedom. The 2 women secretaries of state in the U.S., Madeleine Albright and Condoleezza Rice, have had to walk a fine line between maintaining their femininity and meeting masculinist expectations. Predictably, presidents placed both of them at the Department of State, not defense. While state is not yet regendered, the U.S. view of diplomacy makes it somewhat feminist in the field of international affairs. Regardless of their position, most women describe the atmosphere within the cabinet room as distinctly masculinist. Women ministers use words such as boysy and blokey to characterize cabinet conversations, while admitting they must scramble to stay in the scrum. Women ministers also tend to dismiss or joke about the implications. Many believe that discussions in cabinet meetings matter very little when compared to the significance of decision-making between presidents or prime ministers and their personal staffs. Whether the system is parliamentary or presidential, there has been an increasing tendency for chief executives to go their own way by relying on their personal staffs and circumventing the institutions of the legislature, political parties, and cabinet. Furthermore, within this dramatic development, the individual president or prime minister has moved to the center stage, adding an element of personalization. In general, presidentialization has coincided with the increasing representation of women in cabinet. As a consequence, by the time women arrived in cabinet, this phenomenon had eroded the authority of the institution and diminished the influence of individual ministers. Like many women ministers in the UK, Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, the late Mo Molan, reflected on the success she achieved outside cabinet while expressing frustration, the frustration she felt within it. By contrast to the feminist atmosphere she nurtured in the negotiations, cabinet provided a distinctly different environment in which a single man dominated. While Molan joined the other women in Blair's government who believed the cabinet was not functioning as cabinet government should, she also expressed regret that the Prime Minister's presidential style prevented women from making their unique contribution. She explained, "I mean, I can give you the line that Tony is sympathetic to women. You know what the line is. But he doesn't listen to anybody in cabinet but Gordon Brown. And Gordon Brown is even worse." "I don't think any of them," she continued, "actually fundamentally thinks they need women there. And they do. I think women are better conciliators. So I think there are a lot of advantages women bring to politics, but the men don't necessarily benefit from them. My views are quite jaundiced because I think they use us for window dressing, and they haven't actually accepted us as bona fide women MPs." Molan's experience led her to acquire that jaundiced view after she successfully concluded the agreement that produced the Good Friday Peace Accords. Blair sacked her and put his personal friend, Peter Mandelson, in the post. Among the women in Blair's government's Secretary of State for International Development, Claire Short, proved to be the staunchest, most outspoken critic of his style of leadership. As she described it, "Tony doesn't run a cabinet of equals. He's a very, very great centralizer and dominator." Moreover, Short extended her critique beyond the Prime Minister's personal style. She understood fully the implications of presidentialization for women in cabinet when she recalled, "It wasn't just the women who were being excluded, but as women took their place in Parliament, took their place in cabinet, power moved. I don't think it's cause and effect, but it does have consequences for women." And Short added, "It is notable that Blair's inner groups have no women in them." By the time women arrived at the cabinet room, power had moved to 10 Downing Street, a club that remained reserved for men. The shift in power has had wider, more profound consequences for the Constitution, according to Short. When Blair decided to go to war in Iraq, she resigned, and in her resignation speech, she warned Parliament that the UK had achieved the worst of two worlds, presidential leadership with large parliamentary majorities, producing an excessive concentration of power in the hands of the Prime Minister. Among the negative consequences of presidentialization, Short also emphasized that the Prime Minister's ability to go his own way leads him to overlook the expertise and advice of departments as well as cabinet ministers. While acknowledging that this development had started before 1997, Short observed, "But it's leapt under Blair. We have this prestigious committee for big foreign policy questions, chaired by the Prime Minister, and all the big ministers, plus heads of the intelligence agencies, plus the chief of the defense staff, and it never met. I mean, it's shocking. Everything so informal, it leads to bad decisions." According to Short's assessment, a combination of factors has produced a perilous period in politics, and the British Prime Minister's decision to go to war in Iraq provides the most spectacular example of the dangers. On the other side of the Atlantic, critics of the U.S. president's decision to attack Iraq have rendered a similar critique, although in this case they call the culprit politicization rather than presidentialization. In the politicized presidency, chief executives trust their own staff in the White House more than the professional permanent bureaucracy. Several accounts document how President Bush and a few close associates, including only one cabinet minister, Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, planned the war while circumventing conventional channels, bypassing bureaucratic expertise, and excluding a cabinet member as significant as Secretary of State Colin Powell. As National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice should have played a central role, yet she increasingly moved to the margins of the inner circle, from the 9/11 attacks to the decision to invade Iraq. As the only woman among the foreign policy players inside the White House, Rice also seems to have been the only one who expressed doubts about the decision to go to war. Colin Powell was outside the White House and out of the loop. By most accounts, her voice as an honest broker gradually weakened until she fell silent. While anyone in that lonely position might have done the same, it must have been especially challenging for the only woman to take a softer stance and still struggle to be heard by the president's men. After the decision to go to war, the president moved her out of the White House and over to the State Department. The mass media celebrated the symbolic significance of her appointment as the first black woman Secretary of State. But Rice's step outside the White House and into cabinet constitutes a step down from her previous proximity to the president. The chief executive has become increasingly dominant and personalized in Canada and Australia, as well as in the US and the UK. I mean, Australians recently witnessed a general election that focused almost entirely on Prime Minister John Howard. Some distinctive features of each system affect the degree of presidentialization, but even Prime Minister Clark has observed the phenomenon in New Zealand. Although her cabinet continues to meet weekly, she believes a degree of presidentialization has occurred, despite reformers' efforts to constrain the executive with MMP. As Clark explained, what happened, I think, is that the parliamentary systems are all transforming themselves into presidential systems. And then she added, well, we're the head of government as prime minister, just as the American president is head of government. So there are certain functions that go with being head of government. And sitting around parliament for hours isn't one of them. The adoption of MMP might have stalled presidentialization, but it has not prevented it. Finally, presidentialization not only diminishes the role of women in cabinet, it also intensifies the masculinist nature of the top job. To the extent that Thatcher presidentialized the position of prime minister, she actually fueled changes that could make it more difficult for women prime ministers in the future, at least as long as stereotypes about women continue to raise doubts about their ability to lead. No longer first among equals, the prime minister personally bears responsibility for the fate of the nation. As the only case of a woman prime minister in the UK, Thatcher's extraordinary experience might prove insufficient to indicate that women are capable of carrying out such a commanding role. The more parliamentary systems come to resemble presidential ones, the more daunting the challenge for women as national executives. Just ask Hillary Clinton. In conclusion, executive leadership in Anglo-American systems is distinctly gendered. To assess the nature and consequences of women presidents, prime ministers, and members of cabinet, we need to consider the masculinist character of our institutions, ideology, and development. Otherwise, we will continue to puzzle over the paradox of Anglo nations as models of democracy, while women remain limited in their opportunities to provide executive leadership and engender change. Thank you.
Some time for some questions, if anybody would like to ask some questions. I'm tending to go to non-regular questioners, if I possibly can. Could I begin with a question? From what we know of Hillary Clinton, is she more likely to follow the practice of consulting with Cabinet, of restoring Cabinet to its former position of importance, or is she likely to be forced into the mould of running a one-person band as well?
I think she's likely... I think it's going to be difficult for anyone to restore cabinet were the importance of cabinet. And I think she is as likely as anyone to operate, if not alone, then with a very small circle of close advisors within the White House, rather than reaching out to the formal permanent bureaucracy.
But you'll keep the system that's been put in place.
As a style of leadership, I think so, yes.
I won't ask that whether Bill will be part of that inner circle.
Well, you know, she has said over and over again, she's going to make it very clear who wears the pantsuits in the White House. So she's certainly trying to eliminate people's concerns about that.
Right, well, questions, yes.
I want to thank you for your talk. You touched on an area that is one of those closed in our society. I wondered why I was coming here, because when I saw that this was a talk about women, I thought, well, I'll think about that. And I found only one aspect that I could raise. Why are women privileged as to longevity?
Maybe because they're excluded from politics.
That's the first part. But the end of that is, when it comes to writing wills, who benefits?
Is this a relevant question?
This is trying to get to this point. So I'm sitting here wondering, I'm hearing something, and then all of a sudden you triggered me off. You mentioned Mrs. Thatcher. She only closed schools while she was in that position of education. Try that one on for size. The privileged schools. So then I look down and I find myself, what's this about Ireland? Ireland that can't run a good revolution now turns this into a fire. Go near the teachers' colleges or that, and it's hostility. And then we turn to Australia, and as I'm looking at this, I said, I'm listening to an education talk.
Are we coming to a question
soon?
Yes,
we are. We've arrived at Australia, where they're trying to find out how to pay teachers. On the ladder of opportunity, who's at the bottom of the ladder? Teachers. Now, as I'm looking at this, I'm saying, I've reached my point now.
No good.
I've reached it. It's the French Revolution.
Really?
And for those who don't know the French Revolution, how about finding out why they closed schools? And what was it called, secular instead of atheism? And this has gone around the Anglo world. And teachers are not teaching what they want to teach, which is their ability and skill. They're being used up for political purposes. And everywhere you... And the United States can't even run a school. So I'm asking this. Why not revisit your own words and ask, why are teachers in revolt everywhere until they get paid what an executive CEO...
Yes.
Is entitled to. And now you'll say you can't pay teachers, and you know why. They are simply slaves from the Greek area. Nobody of any concern
from
is only a slave, so they're good enough.
Yes, okay. Thank you for your... Yes, so you have. Thank you. Do you want to respond to any of that?
I think not. That's
right. Now, a question. Why aren't you a bit quicker on your feet? That's what I want to know.
Well, Professor Sykes, I want to ask you whether you think recent developments in Australia perhaps go beyond the rather bleak picture you've painted. If you look at the major commitments of the new government, if you look at the most difficult portfolios, they all seem to be filled by women. Look, for example, at industrial relations, one of the main commitments. That portfolio is filled by a woman, by the Deputy Prime Minister. If you look at climate change, another major commitment, that portfolio is filled by a woman. Education, yes, you've said it's feminist, but the government came to office with a commitment to what it called an education revolution, a major commitment. Again, the portfolio is filled by a woman. And it came with commitments for major reforms in health. So I suggest that in this country we may have gone a little beyond the bleak picture that you have painted?
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to watching the new government. I think it's very exciting that there are a few more women in Australian government. I do think they have been given very difficult jobs, you would probably agree. And that's actually one of the points I made, that when women make it in there, they're not given the glamorous jobs in cabinet by any means. So I think they have substantial challenges that they have to face. I also think, though, it might not just be Australia. I mean, there is a reason to be optimistic. I think throughout the Anglo-American world, we may be seeing the sort of last days of the neoliberal regime, which would mean that education, health, welfare would start to become priorities again, and people would be willing to fund those programs, and I hope women are there to institute the new programs and design them. So I think you're right, we have a lot to look forward to in Australia, and I think maybe even throughout the rest of the Anglo world. So perhaps things will improve. But the women still have tough jobs to do.
You can't tell whether a revolution is taking place until after it's happened. That's the trouble. Now, another question.
In Australia, that is, at the state and territory level, we've had examples of 5 or 6 female leaders, premiers or in charge of the chief officers. Could you explain in your studies how you can explain they can achieve the heights at that level but have been denied it at the national level?
Well, there's a number of ways to answer that question. I do think there might be some reason to be hopeful by looking at what's going on at the subnational level, where women have successfully led in the states and territories in Australia, and also in the United States and Canada. I guess I'm maybe just perpetually pessimistic, but when you say there have been 6, I believe that only in the territories they were elected, which means they followed. Again, there were cases of being handed the poison chalice, I think, in the case of Carmen Lawrence and maybe even Joan Kerner. And so the elected were in Claire Martin. I think Claire Martin is a fascinating example of someone who has succeeded and faced some really daunting obstacles or challenges. I guess one answer about why they might succeed at the local rather than the national level would have to do with the emphasis on domestic rather than international politics. So the most masculinist aspects of executive leadership tend to be that position commanding the troops, committing the troops to war, and that's for the most part removed from states and territories and the concerns of premiers or first ministers. But on the other hand, I also think we should wonder why we don't have more examples to look at below the national level. And I think look very closely where the women have succeeded, as I think Claire Martin has in the Northern Territory. Of course, Anna Bligh will be another important example to follow.
Any other questions?
Is it really a sentient issue of women not being interested in public power? And how do we attract women to be more interested in nominating themselves? I think if we looked at the statistics in Anglo-American, I don't know how it differs from other cultures, but there are very few of us that actually choose to offer ourselves as public figures in a whole range of areas. And how do we deal with that?
Well, it's interesting. Lots of studies have shown that women leaders, not just in Anglo-American countries but worldwide, are drawn into politics because they are motivated by issues and ideology rather than power. So where you ask, well, why do you want, young boy, why do you want to be president? It's, I want to have all that power. The women respond, I want to change the world. I want to make the environment better. I want to, that can mean that women presidents and prime ministers can be extremely influential if they are motivated by ideas rather than power for power's own sake. But I think there is a problem there, and I don't know. Not only do we have difficulty getting more women interested in pursuing positions in public office in these countries, but also they often retire
after they're there for a very short period of time. I mean, that happened also to the class of 1997 in the UK. I mean, quite a few, I don't know the exact number, but quite a few simply chose not to run in the next general election. And that never happened, well, I shouldn't say never. That doesn't, rarely happens with male politicians in the UK or the US. The rates of incumbency are quite high. So it's an interesting question. I mean, I think as long as these systems are aggressive and adversarial and combative, women are put off. You know, the hope is that women will change that environment, but I'm skeptical about the degree to which they can do that when the environment's determined by institutions and, you know, very long histories and traditions of adversarial politics. So I don't know that completely answers, addresses without answering the question. Okay. I'm going to have to find something sort of more cheerful to say on International Women's Day.
I was wondering, you have been talking about the Anglo world, and this is a big question, but is that completely different from other areas? And I was thinking in particular that, for example, in Europe, there were quite a number of ministers of agriculture who were female. And I think especially about the Scandinavian countries and Germany. Also in the Scandinavian countries, there seem to be many more women in parliament, not mm-hmm. only in parliament, but as ministers. Sometimes you see a picture and half of them are women. Mm-hmm. Something which, I mean, here you don't even think that would be possible. Would that, is that a completely different system from the Anglo one?
I think so. In fact, you know, the Scandinavian countries are a wonderful point of contrast. They are different systems. They're not the aggressive, adversarial, confrontational, combative systems of the Anglo world. I mean, they operate with a high degree of consensus. They don't have the same rugged individualism at the root of the law and philosophy. There's a number of contrasts you could draw between not just Scandinavia, but especially Scandinavia and these other countries. So, yeah, Scandinavia is a sharp contrast. At one point, I think at one point Norway had majority of women legislators. I mean, obviously Gro Harlem Brundtland was prime minister for a very long period of time, and she was a feminist, and she brought about feminist changes. Women have dominated politics. But I also think you would say it's a country where, as I said, there's a kind of collectivist consensus about things like health and education and public services. And the state has a much more community-wide sort of basis and perspective than these countries dominated by liberal individualism and bolstered then by institutions that encourage and foster combativeness and aggression. So I think they are. I think that's actually the point, that the problems that we have in common and really do distinguish us. I'm talking only about these countries today, but obviously I'll be making contrasts along the way. And perhaps Scandinavia is almost at the extreme opposite end of the spectrum in terms of the opportunities and experiences of women and the character of government, I think.
They have proportional representation.
That's right. Among other things.
Any last questions?
I think we conveniently forget that I think the number three or four ranking member in the American presidential system is the Speaker of the House and is a woman and is a Democrat. I think that is an achievement that the American, that's probably the highest achievement ever attained by a woman in the United States system. Why was it not possible for her to put herself forward ahead of Senator Clinton, who she clearly outranked and was a Democrat? Was it simply a personal allegiance to a family and her state of California?
No, I think in fact I've emphasized executive leadership, and I think there's a big difference between executive leadership and legislative leadership. That it is in many ways easier for a woman
in the legislative arena, this is why I'm concerned about parliamentary systems becoming more presidential. It is easier, I think, for women. What do you need to do in a legislative context? Do you need to build consensus? You need to build a coalition. You need to conciliate and compromise. And, you know, that is easier for a woman to do. I hear Nancy Pelosi does it with a pretty heavy hand. But those skills are completely different than the skills required of an executive. A wheeler dealer in the White House is not a plus, but what you need in the Congress is exactly that. And so in some ways I think it's not as surprising as it might seem that a woman became Speaker long before she became President. Also, the House of Representatives has a fairly minor role to play in foreign policy, so at least when compared to the Senate, never mind the presidency. So you still, once again, you avoid that issue and the expectations that go along with Commander-in-Chief.
Okay, no, absolutely last question. Well, would you join me in thanking our lecturer for a very stimulating lecture?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really interesting.
Oh, good, thank you.